I sort of got drawn into this in 2001 after I wrote a novel called The Facade. And it had nothing to do with Zechariah Sitchin. I had not heard of him. I had heard of Eric von Daniken.
Sure.
At the time. And then I was on Coast to Coast once, and I got some questions about this. And then also just prior to that, and so I started looking at Zechariah Sitchin. And, you know, at first I thought I'd found a kindred spirit, because this was, you know, by the biographical description, someone who was into ancient Near Eastern studies and also into this sort of thing. It turned out, you know, what I sort of read when I got his books, I got the first two books and read them, you know, it didn't sort of match what my own expectation was. And so I was constantly asked, you know, to comment on this. And so I disagree on a number of issues with Zechariah Sitchin. I don't I don't look at some of the passages in the Bible and some of the Mesopotamian texts the way he does, as far as the idea of them presenting evidence for alien visitation and things like that. But I actually view it as a separate issue from the bigger question of, you know, could there be extraterrestrials? Could they, you know, have come here? Could they come here at some point? I mean, all those to me are separate issues, and they're not really revolving around, you know, this particular issue or this particular person. So I disagreed with him on the basis of sometimes grammar, sometimes translation. I think our biggest, our sharpest disagreements are he has certain really key ideas that he asserts from Mesopotamian tablets. And if you actually go look, for instance, if you look for all the occurrences of Anunnaki, which anyone listening here can do online, all this stuff is online now. It wasn't back in 2003, but now you can look. And some of the things he says about the Anunnaki just aren't there. And so that becomes a real sharp point of contention when I say, look, it's not a translation issue. It's an issue of, is it there or not? And it's not that he's really making it up. What he's doing is he's reading the story, and then he's assigning sort of a narrative over top of it, if that makes any sense. It's like if I read Tom Sawyer, and then for the characters in Tom Sawyer and the places and the events, I sort of put a narrative over that, sort of an interpretive web over that. That's really what he's doing. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's not just, you know, I'm here to sort of make things up and fabricate things and all that sort of thing. It's really sort of a merging of his story that he's imagining on, you know, some of these texts. And it's almost like an allegory. You know, but of course he doesn't view it as an allegory.
Well, you know, in my discussions with him, ongoing, you know, I think he actually believes what he's been able to interpret.
Yeah, I would agree. I think he's completely sincere, and he really feels that he's latched on to something here and really really believes it. Yeah, you know, I've actually heard a number of fairly. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, some of them have been pretty nasty things said about him by other researchers and even other talk show hosts, sort of off the record. And
I call them the internet haters.
Yeah, I'm just not buying that. You know, I've heard really weird things too about how he's a reptilian and he's part of this.
No. I don't think he's a reptilian.
Yeah, come on.
Though I did trip over his tail at the event. You know?
Yeah, it's just really strange. I mean, I
like him. You know, I have a lot of respect for him. He's 90 years old. He and I have developed an interesting relationship. He feels very comfortable with me. When I first started doing this program, you know, he wasn't sure if he wanted to do it. And now, you know, he insists he had retired from doing any radio shows, but he's got another workout, which, you know, we'll talk about when he gets better.
Right.
And, you know, he insisted, he said, no, I have to come on Coast to Coast with George. I want to. And, you know, somebody was like, well, what about this other show? And his publisher would talk to him. He went, no, no, no. I'd like his theories. You know, when I picked up the 12th Planet, his first in a series of books on the Earth Chronicles, I was mesmerized by it. You know, as I've been Edgar Cayce and even you, Michael, with your work, of his interesting theories. So tell me, why is it because of your background in ancient languages and text you believe he's interpreted them wrong? Is that the main issue?
Well, I think really the main issue with me is that, let me give you an illustration. There are certain key ideas.
And let me do a quick overview for people.
Sure.
On what Sitchin believes. He believes that there's another planet in our solar system, comes around every 3,600 years. It's been the basis for worldwide calamities on this planet, floods, you name it, whenever it gets close, in that the inhabitants of that planet needed gold to dump up there in their atmosphere and try to protect it. And they came here. He called them the Anunnaki. And they came to this planet originally to mine gold. They realized that they didn't want to do it anymore. There's too much manual labor. So they genetically altered the species that, you know, was on the planet at the time. And they became us, human beings. And that's his theory. And then there were wars. They fought. They left. And here we are. We were left here. That's a nutshell of his theory. Now go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, let's take the Anunnaki, for example. I mean, there are some really core ideas that he has. The idea that the Anunnaki came here by means of this route of the 12th planet, which in Sitchin's thinking is Nibiru. And so there's this connection between the Anunnaki and Nibiru. There's this 3,600-year cycle of Nibiru. So those are two ideas. And my fundamental problem is that if you actually go look up the Anunnaki, and I actually have a screen capture video of me doing this on my website. It's not exciting. It's Mike, you know, going up to a website called the Electronic Text Corpus of Sumerian Literature. And there are hundreds of Sumerian texts, both in Sumerian transliteration and in English. And the video is of me putting in the Sumerian spelling for Anuna or Anunnaki.
Okay.
And then you get the results. And there's 180 occurrences of the Anunnaki in the Sumerian text.
So it does come up.
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan Gray said a few weeks ago on the show he couldn't even find Anunnaki at all.
Oh, that's crazy.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, it's there a lot. And so what I ask readers to or watchers to do of that video is, look, mimic the search, get the search, because every one of these you can click through to the English translation. And if you do that, you're not going to find any reference to the Anunnaki and connected with Nibiru ever. You're not going to find, if you do it for Nibiru, and I have another video of me looking up Nibiru in something called the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, which is, you know, 20 or about 30 volumes. It's the leading Akkadian and Sumerian dictionary that's available in English.
Okay.
And the University of Chicago actually put it on the web for free. So it's of me looking up Nibiru, going through the pages. Again, it's boring stuff in terms of the excitement level. But the point is that, look, these are core ideas to this particular theory. And my big problem is I don't see it in the text. So it transcends a translation issue at those specific points.
Well,
it is a translation
issue. Who were the Anunnaki? Who did they reference when they did mention 140 times the Anunnaki?
Yeah, the Anunnaki are a group of gods, depending on what era and what Mesopotamian text you're talking about. They can either be a group of gods or a subgroup of the Sumerian pantheon, and they're doing all sorts of things. You know, usually it's kind of like the Old Testament or the Psalms. You know, they're pictured in the divine throne room having conversations or praising Marduk or, you know, rendering some decision. You know, your typical sort of pantheon kind of job description.